Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to be with George Saunders, who has written three books of short stories, Pastoralia, Civil War Land and Bad Decline, and In Persuasion Nation, as well as two books of illustrated fables, The Brief and Frightening Reign of Phil, and The Very Persistent Gappers of Fripp, and now a new collection, which is a collection of essays, parodies, travel pieces, literary criticism, called The Brain Dead Megaphone, published by Riverhead Books. Now, along the way in this collection, while I think that what people remember most are travel pieces to Dubai and exploration of the Mexican-American border in Texas and a trip to Nepal, there's a lot of talk about how George Saunders came to be a writer. And, of course, on Bookworm, well, we want to hear about that. And it's very useful as well. So I thought we'd talk about certain things that come up along the way in these essays and then hear, well, how they all come together in a particular piece at the end of the program that George Saunders will read. The first question I wanted to ask you, you say that when you started, you had a whole different sense that you didn't speak the language that a book speaks, that you had to be something else in order to be a writer.
Yeah, it was, well, I grew up in Chicago on the South Side, and even though that, you know, that world was incredibly literary, it wasn't the world that I saw in books. So I had this idea that you would have to, you know, that a book would be that, it would be 200 pages of you doing that thing you couldn't actually do. But you got lucky in, you know, 6 pages of luck in 1 year and 8 the next. And the idea that you were basically trying to dress up your experience in language that wasn't its own, you know. So, you know, as a kid, Hemingway, as a Hemingway fan, as a young man, I was trying to write about my life in Chicago or later in Amarillo in this Hemingway-esque, simple, brutal diction. And it was, you know, as it always, it's false. So I struggled with that for years. You know, Nick walked into the Walmart. It was pleasant, you know, that kind of thing. So I think it was just the stress of feeling yourself wearing someone else's clothes, and that finally wears out a little bit.
Well, in the piece on Kurt Vonnegut in the book, The Brain Dead Megaphone, you speak about even having a more ponderous literary voice, and I thought I'd ask you to read that section just so we'll know what it was.
How
you
bad
were.
It was. Yeah. Sure. I was, to understate the case, an untrained reader. My understanding of literature at the time was great writing was hard reading. What made something great was you could barely understand it. A scene I'd been imagining as taking place indoors would suddenly sprout stars in a riverfront. At a fictional dinner party at which I'd understood there to be three people present, six were suddenly required, based on the appearance of three unfamiliar names. In addition to the difficulties posed by my dullness, I also selected books oddly. The writers I preferred were writers whose English was least like mine. I believed great writing was done in a language that had as little as possible to do with the one I spoke. The words were similar but arranged more cleverly, less directly. A good literary sentence was like a floor with a hole hidden in it. You dropped into the basement and, scratching your head, thought, why'd he say it that way? He must really be a great writer. Plain American language is like the pale, ineffectual relative you took for granted, always there, a little embarrassing. Plain American was fine for getting around your dopey miniature world, cashing checks and finding restaurants and talking about television and so on. But when the real work of art was required, you hauled out the fancy language, the one nobody used.
George Saunders reading from his piece on Kurt Vonnegut. Now, question. Is there no transformation of ordinary language into the language that you would use in a story?
Yes. It's like this. I'll grow the language out to something sloppy and expansive, and usually a little more formal than it ends up being. And then in the revision process, which for me is kind of OCD and, you know, repetitive, it gets shrunken down into something that's actually a very good imitation of what I think of as natural speech. But of course, as that process implies, it's actually a rarefication of natural speech. But it takes – I mean, if I type something up in a first draft, it's not natural at all. But it's the process of moving towards a sort of Platonic natural speech that, you know, that's what revision is for me.
Well, I've always wondered, because William Carlos Williams, for instance, said that he wanted to write in the language of Polish grandmothers. he was a pediatrician.
Polish.
Yeah. and I'd look at it and say, well, it's beautiful, but that's not the language of Polish grandmothers.
Right. You haven't met the right Polish grandmother yet.
Well, I think he meant the Polish grandmother of poetry.
You right, know,
that one reimagined and transformed. Yeah. Yeah. So in relation to other poems, this was a Polish grandmother.
Right.
Aristocratic Britons.
Right. What I think, I mean, actually, what if I was being completely honest about it, I think what happens is I revise by certain principles that are sort of inward and private and maybe not even defensible. And revising by those principles, the sentences become a certain thing. I'm not even sure I want to know what the overarching principle is. I just know that, you know, for example, I've got a real thing about efficiency. Even if I'm being inefficient, I want to be inefficiently efficient. So it's almost like if you had a certain principle that you – it was sort of a subverbal principle of house decor, say – and I went into your house and I started enacting that principle, taking things out, replacing them, I might not be able to say what it was other than taste. It's taste. Taste repeated ends up being style. So although I think in the end I would say, yeah, I'm trying to write in a natural language, I'm really trying to enact those principles of precision, reduction of the number of words, not being full of it, you know, all these – and some of them – that's a very crude approximation of the principles, but enacting them over and over again produces something. And actually, I don't really care what that is. You know, as long as it's inhabited those principles totally, then I'm happy with it.
Well, the first thing you say you learn is plain language. The second comes from the nuns, who one of whom, a good one, has given you Johnny Tremaine to read, and you say that from that you learned an art of compression, that there were books in the public schools where the sentences feel an obligation to describe everything they see or touch.
Right. In the most banal way possible, in the conventional way, you know. Jimmy, a tow-headed boy of 8, ventured forth into a summer sunny day with the hope of finding some playmates. You know, that kind of stuff.
Instead of just Jimmy went outside.
Right. Or instead of just cut it. Yeah. You know, show Jimmy on the sidewalk. Wait till something happens.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that this Esther Forbes, a Newbery Award winner, is likely to say something brief and pungent. What is the sentence?
The one that I remember all these years later was, on rocky isles, gulls woke. But she had no comma in it, which I remember just seeing as a kid and going, we can do that, you know, and then being struck by the fact that there was a human creator who decided that, you know, she decided that no comma was better than comma. And the thing is, I don't even have anything against wordiness. I mean, Dostoevsky does a good job of it. But I think what I'm saying is the excitement for me was to find out that I did have a quirky personal aesthetic towards the efficient. So indulging that was the path to something good. Whereas if someone has a quirky internal, whatever I said, towards the florid, then engaging that, you know, intelligently, assuming it's grammatical, I guess that would be the...
Yeah, well, you also say that humor is the art of telling you the straight truth in fewer words than you expect.
I think that's the case. Or just telling a truth that is not expected or polite in the given moment. You know, to think of the two of us sitting here chatting very nonchalantly and... You know, at some point this morning we were both standing in our underwear, you know, and at some point we'll both be in a grave. It's kind of funny, you know.
we're stuck being who we are wherever and whoever we are, but the description of us might suddenly astound.
Because many all say descriptions are true, but conventionality says let's describe it as two middle-aged gentlemen, incredibly good-looking gentlemen, sitting in a studio talking to each other, which is certainly a very valid use for language. But when you start looking life really in the face, you see that the 9 million other truths that are simultaneously being enacted at this moment are also they're equally true. You know, it's a choice of language.
So we've got one, plain language, two, compression, and then three, what you call the black box, mm-hmm. and what I would call writing to accomplish what you want.
Right.
you say that writing, in the Kurt Vonnegut sense, is like a black box that the reader enters and leaves changed.
Right, right.
And that whatever is necessary for the writer to do to effect the change he wants. So in the case of Slaughterhouse-Five, the reader enters with what?
Well, I would contrast – let me start by contrasting that with my earlier idea, which was the writer knew very well what he wanted you to feel at the end of the story. So it was a Hemingway-esque model where I really thought and loved this idea that I went to Spain, you know, was gored by a bull, and was made impotent, and then went to World War I and drank absinthe. Then the idea was that you – what I wrote was going to cause you, this person I never met, to – approximately the same emotional state and sensual state that I was in at the end of the process. I really thought that's the way it worked. So as you can imagine, that's impossible for a writer to, you know, I think Mamet talks about the intentional fallacy. How do I know how to move you from point A to point B? I mean, maybe some people can do it, but I can't. It's almost like trying to move something very delicate with extension robot arms. I don't know how to do it. So when I dropped that idea and just thought, I'm going to try to make an intense experience for myself as I write it, try to radically inhabit certain principles of compression and so on, then I don't really know what happens to you on the other side. In a way, I don't care. I want you to be moved from point A to point B. And I think really, since writing is in large part a form of very, you know, beautiful entertainment, the whole idea is that you've got to be moved from A to B. And I think actually where you end up at B is actually not in the artist's power to know. I think. Now, I'm not positive about that, but I think the times when I've thought that I knew where I wanted you to be, those are always failed experiments. When I said, I'm going to pay really close attention to this sentence, and make sure that there's not falseness in there, then there does seem to be emotion at the end. And I think it does have, weirdly, it has a roughly moral trajectory, but I think planning it, you know, I think it's, we've maybe talked about this, but Gerald Stern, I think, said, and I'll clean it up, if you set out to make a poem about two dogs making love and you write a poem about two dogs making love, then you've written a poem about two dogs making love, which is sort of anti-art.
Yeah, but I think that Vonnegut sort of knows that his reader is coming into his black box with an idea of what a novel about war should be like.
Yes.
It should be heroic. You should get to know the guts and blood of some soldier men,
right,
and their interactions should reveal certain heroic truths. And he says, no, I'm going to make a box in which you're going to see that the people who fight wars are children and that the heroics are shattering,
right,
and that you never recover from what you see there. And I'm a funny guy, so it'll sometimes be funny. And I'm thought to be a science fiction writer, so I'll have green creatures.
I think you're right, although I bet you that in real time it was a process-related decision where he ran up against his own nonsense. In other words, as he says in the book, he tried to write that book. And you know, that feeling of you're so deeply dissatisfied that leads you to kick your art up to a higher level. You know, Stuart Dybeck says, a story is always talking to you, and the good artist just listens. So I think Vonnegut's story said, this is the reality and the confusion of war is too big for the shirt you're trying to put it in, and you better break the seams. And I think that's what he did. So my experience in a tiny way is that happens through process, through your own. I'm going through it right now in a piece I'm working. I am so disappointed in what it's turned out to be that I'm about to bust out of that shirt, you know, bust out of the shirt of the preconceptions about it. And that's the fun part.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with George Saunders about his new collection of essays and parodies, occasional pieces, travel pieces called The Braid Dead Megaphone, published by Riverhead. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with George Saunders about his nonfiction collection, The Brain Dead Megaphone. Now, let's see where we are. We've got, in plain language, which has been compressed to the point of a poetry of sorts, if not a literary poetry, of a story that has to become not a story, but kind of a black box through which the reader passes. The events are processing the reader to effect a change at the other end. Well, it seems like we've entered the phase, in a sense, of deconstruction and anarchy, except that you talk about something that you call the pattern tale. Mm-hmm. And I think that the pattern of the pattern tale gives shape to some of the newly invented chaos that we've had by chopping the story up in the mystery box. Can you talk about what a pattern tale is?
Yeah, that's very well put. What you just said. I wish you'd record it. Oh, you did. Good. Basically, the pattern story is I went to work on Wednesday, and somebody had put a box of arsenic on my desk. I went to work on Thursday, and there were two boxes of arsenic on my desk. I went to work on Friday, and there you have it. Because, or the even maybe better example is, once there was a dog with two heads. Well, in both cases, your mind is leaning forward, saying, "What happened on Friday? Did the two heads talk to each other? Did they get along?" So I think that's actually, when I teach at Syracuse, I always think that it's kind of, I mean, you want to be too careful. You want to be careful not to get too rational about this stuff. But I do think that stories are made up of small, almost like DNA-type units of creating an expectation and exploiting it. If you create an expectation and exploit it too randomly, our interest drops, you know. If you create an expectation and exploit it too neatly, we get disappointed. So the pattern story, as I talk about in this book, Bartholomew, is just the school, is just a way of making it clear between the two of us what the next step should be. And then complicating the next step so it's not too neat.
So we've changed plot expectation into the expectation based upon incremental repetition. And what Donald would have said, because I can say this here because he was
oh, no,
a
he
friend. Yes, he would. He would have said that the pattern is based on jazz, that you're
right.
playing.
I would agree with him.
You're playing the melody, and now we're going to
exactly
have a
right.
whole series of variations, wilder and wilder, in which the melody is going to be more and more surprising, become more and more personal to the musician, and, you know, reemerge
right.
in a new and completely surprising form.
But never be forgotten by the listener. It's always in the background. And I think the thing that's fascinating and mysterious is that meaning, as we talk about it, is made in the audacity of the variations, you know. And that's how we like to talk about a story like the school as being about mortality, which it is. But the delight is not in the theme. The delight is in the audacity of the variations.
Now, we're going to be hearing very shortly my guest, George Saunders, read his story, Manifesto. And I want you to watch as all these principles, repetition, compression, mystery, come into play. And what I want to begin before he reads it with is that it's dependent upon an idea that gets introduced earlier in this collection of essays, that there's a group called PRKA. Who are they?
They're probably you and me and people reluctant to kill for an abstraction. This
people
is my new terrorist organization that I'm beginning.
and you know, they're a threat to the government because they won't do the things the government wants them to do.
They have stronger bonds than national bonds, which is naughty.
Yes, not a good idea. Right. And they appear in a piece called A Review of the Literature. And now, at the end of the collection, The Brain Dead Megaphone, they're going to speak for themselves. They're going to be implicitly speaking against the rantings of The Brain Dead Megaphone, which in this book is the things that the country media has learned how to say in answer to the profit motive and the desire to stimulate and gain more attention than others. This megaphone speaks too loudly, so these people are going to speak quietly. The Brain Dead megaphone rants with generalities, so these people want to find specific instances. But in particular, in a sense, they want their manifesto to sound like something human. And as we move through, we're going to be initially shocked by the plainness and obviousness of what they have to say until we're warmed by the humanness. That seems to be phase two of the story. Uh-oh, they're talking about our world, you know, bombs and the rest of it. This is George Saunders reading Manifesto, the final piece in his collection, The Brain Dead Megaphone, published by Riverhead.
Now it can be told. Last Thursday, my organization, People Reluctant to Kill for an Abstraction, PRKA, orchestrated an overwhelming show of force around the globe. At precisely 9 in the morning, working with focus and stealth, our entire membership succeeded in simultaneously beheading no one. At 9:30, we embarked upon phase two, during which our entire membership simultaneously did not force a single man to simulate sex with another man. At 10, phase three began, during which not a single one of us blew himself or herself up in a crowded public place. No civilians were literally turned inside out via our powerful explosives. No previously funny person was reduced to a baggy pile of bloody leaking flesh by us during this phase of our operation. In addition, at 11, in phase four, 00 planes were flown into buildings. All of this was accomplished so surreptitiously it attracted little public notice. During phase five, just after lunch, while continuing to avoid the activities listed above, we were able to avoid bulldozing a single home. Furthermore, we set on roads in every city and every nation in the world a total of 00 roadside bombs, which, not being there, did not subsequently explode, killing, maiming a total of nobody. No bombs, cluster bombs, or rockets were launched into crowded civilian neighborhoods, from which, it was observed, no post-bomb sickening momentary silences could be heard. These silences were, in all cases, followed by no unimaginable grief-stricken bellows of rage and loss. No sleeping babies were awakened from sleep by the sudden collapse and or bursting into flame of his or her domicile, followed by the tortured screams of his or her family members during phase five. In the early afternoon, phase six, our membership focused on using 00 trained dogs to bite terrorize naked prisoners. In addition, no stun guns, rubber batons, rubber bullets, tear gas, or real bullets were used by our membership on any individual anywhere in the world. No one was forced to don a hood. No teeth were pulled in darkened rooms. Drills were not used on human flesh, nor were whips or flames. No one was reduced to hysterical tears via a series of blows to the head or body by us. Our membership, while casting no racial or ethnic aspersions, skillfully continued not to rape, gang rape, or sexually assault a single person. On the contrary, during this afternoon phase, many of our membership engaged in tender, loving sexual acts, flirted happily, and even consoled, in a non-sexual way, individuals to whom they were attracted, putting aside their sexual feelings out of a sudden welling of empathy. As night fell, our membership harbored no secret feelings of rage or hatred, or, if they did, prayed, meditated, or discussed these feelings with a friend until such time as the feelings abated or were understood to be symptomatic of some deeper sadness. at which time they made silent promises to continue to struggle with these feelings. It should be noted that, in addition to the above listed and planned activities completed by our members, a number of unplanned activities were completed by part-time members or even non-members. In Chitral, Pakistan, for example, a new Al-Qaeda recruit remembered an elderly American woman who had once made him laugh with a snide remark about an ugly lampshade, and the way that, as she made the remark, she touched his arm like a mother. In Gaza, an Israeli soldier and a young Palestinian exchanged a brief look of mutual shame. In London, a bitter homophobic grandfather, whose grocery bag broke open, gave a loaf of very nice bread to a balding gay man who stopped to help him. A stooped, toothless woman in Tokyo pounded her head with her hands, tired beyond belief of her lifelong feelings of anger and negativity, and silently prayed that her heart would somehow miraculously be opened before it was too late. In Syracuse, New York, holding the broken body of his kitten, a man wept. Who are we? A word about our membership. Since the world began, we've gone about our work quietly, resisting the urge to generalize, insisting upon valuing the individual over the group, the actual over the conceptual, the inherent sweetness of a peaceful moment over the theoretically peaceful future supposedly to be obtained via murder or massacre. Many of us have trouble sleeping and lie awake at night, worrying about something catastrophic befalling someone we love. We rise in the morning with no plans to convert anyone via beating, humiliation, murder, or invasion. To tell the truth, we're tired. We work. We would just like some peace and quiet. When wrong, we think about it a while, then apologize. We stand under awnings during urban thunderstorms, moved to thoughtfulness by the beautiful, troubled, umbrella-tinged faces rushing by. In moments of crisis, we pat one another awkwardly on the back, mumbling shy truisms. Rushing to an appointment, remembering a friend who's passed away, our eyes well with tears and we think, well, my God, I was lucky just to have known him. This is us. This is who we are. This is PRKA. To those who would oppose us, I would simply say, we are many. We are worldwide. We, in fact, outnumber you. Though you're louder, though you create a momentary ripple on the water of life, we will endure and prevail. Join us. Resistance is futile.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been talking with George Saunders, author most recently of The Brain Dead Megaphone, published by Riverhead. Thank you, George, for joining me showing us step by step through a bit of process.
Always a pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.